Welcome back to our podcast, The Family Doctor, Lessons Learned, Wisdom Shared. Dr. Lee Beatty and I started this podcast back in 2021 with the goal of learning from our colleagues in family medicine to hear their lessons and hear their wisdom. We have interviewed a number of amazing individuals, and this podcast has certainly surpassed our highest hopes. Thanks for your support and your feedback. Through this journey, Dr. Beatty and I have had many in-depth discussions reflecting on our careers and about many of the topics that have come up during our episodes. One was the concept of touch in medicine and how important that is. And we actually devoted an entire episode to the topic of touch months ago. We called it a clinical mini lesson. Today's mini lesson is devoted to the topic of referrals. When should the family physician consider a referral to a specialty colleague? How does the family physician make an effective referral? And how does he or she teach and lead their staff in making that referral effective? I'll be discussing all this with my colleague, Dr. Beatty, on this podcast. You already know Dr. Beatty very well. Welcome, Dr. Lee Beatty.
Thanks a lot, Tom. I appreciate that. You know, one of these days in one of these podcasts, we're going to have to get your story. So listeners out there, start flooding the emails with the request for Tom White's story coming up in a future episode.
It may be a while before we need to do that. Lee, I appreciate you joining me for this. I don't know when we started talking about referrals, but I know it came up a number of times when we were reminiscing about practice and the way we did things and the way things changed over the years. And I think we finally decided this was indeed a worthwhile topic to talk about, because you don't read much about it, you don't hear much about it. And yet there really is there's an art to it, and it's critical. It's absolutely critical to the to giving the best care possible to our patients. So thanks for coming up with this idea, and look forward to talking to you about it. Why don't you start off just sharing what'd you learn about referrals in your career?
Well, Tom, I think the first thing we need to do, so that younger physicians who may not know about the history of family medicine in the U.S. and North Carolina may not know what it was like 40 years ago. And it seems like just an incredibly long time ago in a very, very different world. And also maybe for those older physicians who would just need to reminisce every once in a while, I thought what I would first do is just review how family medicine was practiced about 40 years ago. Let's imagine that it's back in 1981, and Dr. Dave Locklear and I were the first residency trained family medicine doctors in Gaston County. That's close to Charlotte. Back then, 70 to 80% of our patients were directly involved in the textile industry. We took out a loan. We set up a triple-wide modular unit, not a double-wide, a triple-wide. We went big when we first started.
Went big.
We went big.
Go big we or hired go home. A great,
right. Yeah, right. That's it. We hired a great pediatric nurse and a few staff, and then we set out our shingle, and it was right beside the post office in Belmont. We jumped right in. We practiced full-scope family medicine. We didn't do OB deliveries, but we did prenatal care for the health department for a couple of years, and had a huge pediatric panel, which I love. We practiced full-scope hospital care at three different hospitals, and we were the attending physicians for patients in the ICU, the heart unit, NICU, the nursery, all of those things. Dave and I had trained at one of those hospitals, Charlotte Memorial, which is now called Carolina's Medical Center. And thus, we knew the best and most collegial specialist when we started because they had been our teachers. So while we rounded in the hospital, we forged even stronger relationships with those specialist colleagues because we saw them in the halls in the doctor lounge.
Lee, this is a little off the subject of referrals, but it certainly is pertinent to building a great practice off the ground. You mentioned you hired a pediatric nurse. Now,
yes,
that was very intentional, wasn't it?
It was indeed.
Yeah.
Sure was. We knew that it was for us to do what we wanted to do, which was to, and there were no pediatricians in Belmont, Mount Holly. There were only one small group of pediatricians in Gastonia. This is a county of about 125, 150,000 people at the time. So we loved pediatrics and we wanted to practice. So we knew that would really be the biggest draw for us is to have a really excellent pediatric nurse.
Yeah. And your practice was a role model for me because in the early years of my practice, 40% of my practice was pediatrics. And I bet yours was about the same.
It was about the same. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was great.
Yeah. So great. So go ahead. You were saying there are very few subspecialists back at that time. You knew a lot of them. You knew them, but there weren't many. Is that right?
Yeah, right. I mean, like, for instance, there were no neuroradiologists or interventional radiologists. You just had radiologists. And they loved to teach and were always available for a phone call. There wasn't such a thing as, at the time anyway, very, very few advanced care providers such as nurse practitioners and PAs. So the generalist community, the internists, the pediatricians, the family medicine people, they interface directly with their specialist colleagues. So talking about how we did referrals, let's just talk about the process maybe for a minute. We dictated and sent by letter or this newfangled thing called a fax machine, a detailed referral letter when we sent our patient to one of the specialists. The letter, we tried to make it one page. It would introduce the patient, give pertinent history, physical results of the test, and finally, most importantly, it would declare clearly the reason why we were sending the patient and what recommendations we were seeking.
And sometimes you would actually call that specialist before you even sent the letter, right? You'd
Absolutely.
Call them and say, "Hey, I've got this patient. I'm not quite sure what to do. Would this be an appropriate patient for you to see?"
Yeah.
I mean, it was very collegial at that time.
Yeah. And as a matter of fact, I was going to say, you may not call them because you may talk to them in the hallway at the hospital or in the doctor's lounge.
Exactly. Yeah.
In return, then, after the consultant would do his or her visit, they send findings and recommendations. And then what was good was that specialist would delineate who was responsible for enacting the steps in the treatment plan. That didn't always work. There were a few specialists early on who, I think because family medicine was so new in the area, they just sort of took over. And so you had to train those people and call them or write them and say, "No, we can take care of that. Just let me know what you think we ought to do, and then I can take it from there." But most of those specialist notes were just great. They were teaching pearls, and it was from somebody that you knew and that you trusted. I almost always knew the consultant. I could manage the expectations of my patient and make them feel confident about the upcoming specialist visit since I already knew them. And, you know, you could say stuff like, "Hey, you'll love this doctor. I know her well." And then often the patient would come back to me and say, "Wow, Dr. Beatty, Dr. Smith says she loves seeing your patients." It was a good collaborative system. It was mutually supportive. educational. Like you say, it was collegial.
Yeah. So, and at that time, although there were certainly groups of orthopedists, there were groups of cardiologists, but pretty much all the different subspecialists at that time, you know, they were employed by themselves, right?
Yes.
This was before the larger systems, right?
Exactly.
So that has changed. That changed over the years. And what were some of the other things that changed about that referral process? Not only who the subspecialist worked for, but, you know, how you interacted with them, how you communicated with them. I suspect you, like I did, there came a time when you weren't visiting the hospital. You weren't going in the doctor's lounge to get coffee in the morning. Mm-hmm. You just weren't seeing these colleagues anymore. It was all,
right.
You know, it was all either telephone or electronic.
Well, and you have to remember that back 40 years ago, basically medicine at that time was still what some people refer to as a, quote, cottage industry. You know, mm-hmm. it wasn't corporate medicine. You know, doctors literally did establish their own practices, hang out their shingle, worked independently. And I think the reason that things changed tremendously is it's multiple factors. But I think the biggest change that we saw was that the old payment system that we started off with, the 100% fee for service, was replaced by various forms of managed care. So when managed care insurance plans and Medicare adjustments began in the late 80s and early 90s, sometimes my network of consultants that I'd use was not necessarily in my patient's managed care plan. And that was really true for the first few years when this was introduced, because the people were joining a particular managed care plan, and then that plan was being bought by somebody else. And then it really was confusing and a mess. And then on top of that, you had not only was the payment structure changing, there's also technology. Like all of a sudden, instead of a fax machine and a telephone, you had the internet, emails, and electronic health records. And, you know, the electronic health record, we're going to talk more about this in a little bit, but it's been touted as a miraculous tool, which it is. It's supposedly to make things more efficient and data-driven. That is true. But, you know, like any great tool, it's a double-edged sword. It cuts both ways. And so I think one of the things that's been forgotten because of this is the elegant referral letter. And I think everybody who's listening to this probably recognizes that sometimes now, instead of a referral letter, you might be sending 40 pages of, you know, repetitive notes that the consultant has to wade through. And that's a shame. Now, on the other hand, as we all know, those 40 pages of repetition have helped family docs to a degree because of the rules that are out there to code what they should be coded as, a level 4 or 5 charge. But in this case, when you're talking about a referral to someone, I think that, you know, brevity is and accuracy and precision are the best ways to go. One other thing, of course, Tom, is that we had autonomous independent practices. And then, you know, in the 90s and really into the 2000s, those practices have been bought out by large hospital systems. And I think in a lot of ways that's challenged and sometimes eroded the old relationship between community physician and consulting physicians. As a matter of fact, I think many newly minted family physicians who are exclusively office practitioners may never see the inside of a hospital again after residency. So they don't have that wonderful bonding that you and I had at the beginning of our practice. The other thing, of course, if you have a hospital system, they're going to want you to use their specialty doctors that brings in revenue to their hospitals and specifically to the hospitals. So, because that's still their biggest moneymaker, their biggest, as they say, revenue stream. So then because of that, there's a lot of centralization that has occurred. They often set up a centralized referral departments, and they're staffed by clerks oftentimes. The clerks are trained to look at a list of system specialists, and then they pick the specialist for you, especially if the referring doctor doesn't state a preference. My message is, family physicians, state your preference and know who the people that are that you want to refer your patients to. Very important. So, you know, if with that system where the clerk picks the specialist rather than the physician, it's just not conducive for patient confidence building. And it's certainly not convenient for and good for a physician-physician relationship. I think, you know, Tom, and what we have talked about mostly in our podcast over the last couple of years, and it's been 2 years, hasn't it? Almost 2 years.
Yeah.
What we've talked about mostly is the doctor-patient relationship. What we're talking about today is enhancing, improving the physician-physician relationship. So I think that's my main message here, is that we can't do it by just using a clerk to get us the earliest appointment. We have to be able to go out there and establish those relationships. I have a few ideas on how we can do that. One other challenge is when you do make that referral nowadays, who is the patient actually seeing? More than likely, that the first person that in that specialty office will see is a nurse practitioner or physician assistant. Because I think the health system encourages those specialists to not waste valuable procedure time. So that's another barrier, I think, inhibiting physician-physician interaction. On the other hand, I think advanced care providers have certainly added a lot to medical systems. I'm not knocking them at all. I've just had some recent experience with an outstanding physician assistant. Honestly, did a better job of explaining things than the specialist that I saw.
Yeah. So, Lee, I know this is going to sound like one of those you know, we used to walk 3 miles in the snow to get to school kind of yeah, stories.
Exactly.
But somehow in my memory, it seemed like there was a time when I would call one of my subspecialty colleagues, briefly tell them about the patient and ask, would this be an appropriate patient for you to see? Do you think you can help me? What do you think? And it just seemed to me, and maybe I don't remember well, but they would say, oh, yeah, well, have them come to my office at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning, or I'll see them tomorrow at 4 o'clock, or give me their phone number. I'll have my nurse call them, and I'll see them. I'll work them in. In today's world, Well, first, it's more difficult to get to the doctor on the phone, and then the wait time to get someone in is sometimes just unacceptable. And then the patient is disappointed because you said, well, I'm going to refer you to my cardiology colleague over here. Then they come back, and again, it may be... they may be a little bit incorrect in their assessment, but their complaint is, well, I didn't see that heart doctor. I saw a nurse practitioner.
Right.
So they got in within 2 weeks to see the nurse practitioner because they were told, well, it'll be 3 months before you can see Dr. So-and-so. I mean, I think all that has changed. Or Is my memory incorrect?
No, it's changed dramatically. But, you know, I guess really everything has changed. And I haven't been in the halls of a hospital to actually see patients in 20 years. But in spite of all of that, I've just refused to send, I refuse to send my patients to doctors that I just didn't know.
Right, right. That's just so critical because that's what our patients trust us to do.
Yeah.
They don't want us just to go to a directory and pick out someone that they want to know that who we're sending them to is someone that we would go to ourselves or we would send our family member to. That's right. That's a basic trust our patients right. have.
Right. And here's the way I always thought about it with a consultant. We have had a really good talk, you and I, about the power of touch in medicine. That is an absolutely essential, integral part of what we do as family doctors. But also, I think that we should look at the specialists that we refer our patients to, the consultants that we use, as an extension of ourselves. Mm-hmm. That care is the care that we would want for ourselves and that we definitely want for our patients. I can't agree with you more.
Yeah. So, Lee, I want to ask you in a minute sort of exactly how you did that referral process. What are some of the pearls that you would want to share? But before that, just briefly, Lee, just address a little bit. How did you know when you needed to make a referral? Were there multiple reasons? Was it, you know, the complexity of the case? Was it a procedure that you just weren't able to perform in your office? Was it sometimes the patient, you just sensed that the patient needed a second opinion? Back when we were in our prime, if you will, patients didn't come in with a Google search and said, well, I think I have polymyalgia rheumatica, and my nephew who lives in Seattle says I need to go to this particular rheumatologist.
So do all my Facebook friends.
Yeah. So how did you know? What were some of the clues? What was that little trigger voice that told you it's time for a referral?
Well, I think you've already said it. There's no one size that fits all. You have that patient who is just very, very concerned, or their family is very concerned. I learned pretty early on that one of the worst things that you can do as a physician is to act defensive or project this thing of, I know everything, that authoritative type of thing. Mm-hmm. So it has to be a mutual decision. The patient really needs to feel that they are invested in this, that they have ownership. One of the ways that you help to empower a patient is by saying, here are our options here. These are the things that we could possibly do. I could do some lab tests for this polymyalgia rheumatica that is definitely one of the possibilities here. Or we can consider a rheumatology referral. I have a couple of people that I think that would be good in that regard. What do you think would be the best thing for you, Mrs. Smith? And oftentimes, when you would offer it like that, the mm-hmm. fact that you're giving mm-hmm. people options, they oftentimes would say, okay, well, let's try this here, okay? And then if that doesn't work, and then when you've done that, instead of it being you that's pushing this, it's really a collaboration.
Well, that's,
and so that's one of the ways that I came up with the decision.
This is also a good point to make here about our specialty, family medicine. Even to this day, there are patients who don't know what we are capable of doing. Even today, I have patients that have been in my practice for many, many years. And there's one that'll occasionally say, well, I didn't know you took skin tags off, or I didn't know you could inject a joint, or I didn't know you could do an EKG here in the office and actually interpret it. I mean, there is still an ongoing need for us to educate the public about what we as family physicians trained in our specialty very broadly that we're able to do. We still have work to do with that, don't we?
Yeah, we do. And I think it's a good idea. If you have like so many of our guests have said, if you have developed and have a great interest in a specific skill, you've gotten the training, you've gotten the experience, letting people know that those things are available right here in Mount Holly, right in Belmont, right in Cherryville, is a great thing. Now, there's another way of looking at that too, Tom. I'm sure you had plenty of patients who didn't want to go anywhere else.
Oh, exactly. They wanted me to do things that I wouldn't dare do. But they said, I don't want to go to the big city. I trust you. You're the only doctor I would let do that anyway.
Right. Yeah. You know, it's funny. For those people who don't know, Belmont and Mount Holly are on the east side of Gaston County. And there, it's only from Mount Holly, and Belmont both, it's only about 10 miles, a 20-minute drive from there to most of the hospitals and the doctor's offices and all the ivory towers and all that sort of thing. But I literally had patients who thought that the Catawba River was like the Korean DMZ. You could not, I mean, there's no way that you could go across the river to see anybody. So, it goes both ways in that regard. But that's... it's wonderful that people would feel that confident with you. But then there you go, is you can then say, I appreciate that, the fact that you have such confidence in me. And I'll tell you what, I have great confidence in this person that has done a whole lot more of these things than I have. And I know this person well. I think he'll do real well with them. And they'll be communicating with me. I'll know exactly when you come back in to see me, I'll be able to tell you everything that happened. And also, if you have any questions, then I'll be able to sort of help interpret things for you, which, by the way, is one of our primary roles. Is actually, we are interpreters for our patients. That's another role that we should embrace.
It's a very undervalued role as well.
Yes.
Very undervalued. Right. Yeah. So, Lee, I think it's real important just to touch on something. That's the whole economic sort of financial part of this. So people don't know this who are listening unless they practiced back then. But back in the mid-80s, you were talking about managed care companies coming on the scene.
Yeah.
Now, this didn't last long, but there was a short period of time when we were fully capitated in primary care. So we were given this panel of patients and we were going to take care of them. And if we referred, we were often penalized financially because it came out of our capitated pool of money. Now, fortunately, that didn't last long. But that was a very uncomfortable situation. It made for some strained relationships with patients. So fortunately, it didn't, you know, that didn't persist and permeate medicine, at least in our region, in our state, for very long. But fast forward, you know, even today, there's a significant burden on the family physician. So they may be able to inject knees, they may be able to do procedures, but you got to know and be real, you got to think real carefully, am I doing this for financial gain or not? You have to really think very carefully and present to the patient. So you're not just keeping them in your office for financial gain. At the end of the day, you're truly doing what's best for the patient.
What's best for the patient. And I think that's another pressure on the other end of the spectrum for family physicians these days. You may be very, very well trained and very confident and skilled in a particular procedure just really know a certain subject really well. And there's sometimes subtle and sometimes not so subtle pressure from the hospital system that you might be engaged with that says, what we want to see is volume. We want you to move people through there.
That's right.
And that's, right. That's something that we family physicians need to resist as well. I mean, if you can do it, and we've had 2 years of incredible people who have shown the multitude of skills that they have acquired through the years. We need to continue to use those.
Right. So Lee, what are some other pearls you want to share about the referral process? Can you give us three or four? Okay, this is, you remember these, you do these, and your referral process is going to go much smoother, more efficiently. Patients are going to be happier, and your consultants are going to be happier. What are a few things that you would suggest we remember and do?
Sure. What I'm going to tell you is not an exhaustive list. As a matter of fact, I really encourage our listeners out there to send us their ideas about things that they do to help that physician-physician relationship, all for the benefit of our patients. I would love to get some emails from folks and have some other ideas which we could possibly announce for subsequent visits. Some of these are things that for the last 10 or 15 years that I did and found out that I had to do to help with that physician-physician relationship. One thing was I would familiarize myself with the panel of specialist physicians in the hospital system that I worked in. I actually would, you know, those profiles that you see now online of people, where they trained, mm-hmm. what their specialties mm-hmm. are. A lot of times they'll have little videos. I actually look at those things and I studied them. And it was good to know at least that amount of information. And then when you actually do talk to somebody, you can say, hey, I see that you were, at Wake Forest. That's great. It helps to establish a connection. Mm-hmm. Also, when a hospital system, a lot of our more urban comrades know about this. Oftentimes the system, the hospital system will have a physician liaison person who can then sort of hook you up with meetups between a specialist group and you. We took advantage of those. That was very helpful. At least you get to see somebody in the flesh, be able to talk with them and make that connection. Now, on the other hand, I, over the years, I had established a few familiar specialists out that outside of the in-house panel, but that I knew maybe that my patients would do best with that particular person for one reason or another. And of course, if the insurance allowed, that's what I would do. And then, of course, if you're in the system, it's nice because that person can then, the consultant can actually look at the electronic health record. But I would print out the appropriate records for the patient to hand deliver to specialists if I was concerned that they may not be able to get the records until I retired. I still did a referral note. It might be just a couple of paragraphs at the end of a management plan, but that's the one that I wanted the consultant to look at. Don't just send 40 pages of electronic health record. Also, when I would refer, I'd give specific requests directly to our in-office referral coordinator. At our office, at least when I left, I suspect that it may be becoming more centralized. Sometimes, honestly, we realized that we had to do workarounds rather than use the central system. I would have my nurse personally do it. We tried to establish hotlines and special numbers that we could call. And develop relationships, not just with me and the doctor, but with my assistant and that doctor's assistant. That seemed to be very helpful.
Right.
Because of the way systems are put together now, doctors, I think, are just not used to communicating with their colleagues as much as they used to, as we've already talked about. It amazes me so many times when I really did feel like I needed to talk to a specialty colleague about a particular patient and actually have a dialogue with them rather than an email, that I had a hard time getting in touch with that doctor. And mainly, I'd have to sit there and wait online and wait on the phone. So I made it a point. This goes both ways, and this may, some people may disagree with this, but I made it a point to, if I had a special or any kind of physician colleague who called our office and wanted to speak to me, I went and spoke to them. Hmm. And they didn't have to wait 10 minutes until I finished with that next patient. I was called out of the room. And I don't know, of course, unless I'm in the middle of doing a procedure, and I would do that. I think that was just the courteous thing to do. And I made a point to let the specialist know that they could always do that. And then I would expect the same I had to call them.
And Lee, I suspect you generally or always let the patient in that room know, I'm going out to talk to a specialty colleague. They're calling about a patient. I really hate to do this, but I would do it. You know, if this was about you, I would take the call. In other words, you'd make it clear this is not, you're not going out to take a call about on something trivial or personal. It's about a patient. And then that patient in the room is thinking, well, golly, if Dr. Beatty cares that much about that patient, I bet he cares that much about me too.
Yeah. And you know what, Tom, in a small town, that patient knows that person could be their neighbor, or the person that they see in Sunday school, whatever. Yes, yeah. That's exactly what I would do. That's a good point.
Yeah. And in today's world, I've learned I don't even carry my cell phone in the exam room, but my staff knows they can come get me if there's a phone call like that.
Yeah. That's a great courtesy. I commend you for that. That's great.
Yeah.
As far as anything else, sometimes consultants would want me to fill out a referral form. I would fill it out. The way I looked at it is, if they have that form for me to fill out, which, by the way, the demographics and stuff, I can have an assistant do that for me. But that is an attempt to have good communication between physicians. So I wouldn't whine. I think it was a sincere attempt to get that referral process right. I would constantly try to cultivate a small group of go-to consultants in various specialties. The cardiologist that I had a good relationship with, who maybe I don't even use them for a particular consultation, but because of that relationship that I have with them, I can call them or email them and ask for their input. And so many times, they would refer me to the right person, and they would feel appreciated. You know, pick their brain, make them feel special and appreciated. By establishing those collegial relationships, what happens is you turn those doctors into, there's another referral from Dr. Beatty. It's more that, I'm going to be an advocate for Dr. Beatty's patient. When they know you and they respect you, they want to help.
Right.
So that's another big thing that I tried to do.
No, that's very good, Pearl. Yeah.
One point is always solicit honest feedback from patients about their experience with the consultant that you referred to. And don't just go to the Press Ganey score, okay? Ask the patient directly. And then what I would do is I would respectfully counsel with the consultant as necessary, or if necessary, even modify the consultant list. I think it's very important that your patients feel comfortable with the consultant that you go with. You think of the consultant not only as a colleague, but as an extension of your own care.
Right. Right. I want to just reemphasize something I said earlier, and I've tried to make it part of my practice, and my patients know this because I've said it 5,000 times in my 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
I would try to make it very clear, you know, how well do I know this specialist I'm sending you to? And I would be clear, well, I don't know them personally. I wouldn't know them perhaps if I passed them in a parking lot, but I know their care. I've sent many patients to them, and I would go to them myself. I would send one of my
yes.
family members. I try to make it right. first really clear, how well do I know them professionally? But then, would I go to them myself, or would I send a family member? The more times I reassured people about that, it just strengthened that referral process just immensely.
Absolutely. You know, and I would even tell, if I knew this, especially if I knew the doctor or knew the feedback that we get from patients, I might even give them a heads up and say, okay, this person is the best in their field. I would go to them in a heartbeat. They may be just the facts, ma'am. It might be like the old TV show Dragnet,
mm-hmm.
But at the end, you're gonna like what they are, and they're going to warm up to you as the visit goes on.
Right,
and that really helped a lot for folks to know what kind of style is that. Mm-hmm. You know, it may not be like me, and mm-hmm. that may be a good thing. But that was also helpful to do that, if you can.
Yeah, there's another thing that happens in today's world more than it used to, is the patient will come in and they already have a piece of paper or a printout from their computer at home. And I want to go see this particular doctor. Will you refer me? And, you know, this may be one of those specialists that you've scratched from your go-to list. It may be someone you've
yeah.
used in the past, and you've had some bad experiences. So it's not someone. And how to handle that is part of this art of the referral. You know,
yes.
I, there have been times when I've said, well, I know of Dr. So-and-so. I'm confident they're well-trained. I wish I knew them better. If you hadn't given me that printout or you hadn't mentioned his or her name, let me tell you who I would use if you had not suggested someone. And I would just, I still do, try to very carefully and politely and professionally, if I think they're making a wrong choice, steer them away from that person. And yet at the end of the day, it's real important to respect patients' wishes. And that's a very important balancing act.
Yeah. But again, it's you're focused on the patient. You want to do the best for that person.
Yeah.
So you give them a good heads up, and you do it in a respectful way.
Yeah. Yeah. Very good.
Well, Tom, things have changed a lot in the last 40 years. Now we have family physicians who do work for large organizations. And we have some like you who have continued to work in small towns and more rural type practices and have been able to continue their independence. How do you see the difference now, or is there a difference between the system physician versus how you practice now as far as referrals?
Yeah. So no, that's a good question. And part of it is just, 35 years ago versus today. And then part of it is the whole employment aspect. So one thing I just wanted to mention that I don't think happens now, but I bet you remember when I opened my practice when I joined a practice in Charlotte for that brief period of time, then I came to Cherryville in 1988, opened a practice. Mm-hmm. I got dozens and dozens and dozens of notes and letters and cards from specialists all over. They had seen my announcement or they heard, and they wrote me this incredibly nice letter. So excited to hear that you are opening your family medicine practice in Cherryville. I remember you from your ear, nose, and throat rotation during residency. I mean, it was tons of these congratulatory letters. I don't think that happens anymore.
Right.
I saved every one of them. Now,
yeah, that's right. Keep a happy file. That's a really important thing for docs to do.
Yeah. Thank you letters from patients. And keep that file and occasionally look at it when the times are tough. But as far as being employed, so it was interesting, I started off independent, as I said, then I was part of a system. And I think as the years went on being part of that system, I became more and more inclined to simply refer to the specialists that were also employed by that system. I got to know them reasonably well, though it was much, much less personal than early in my career. But I knew who to go to for an orthopedic problem or a cardiac problem or dermatology. And truth is, you are very much encouraged to keep things in-house when you are employed. There's a lot of advantages to that. You all share the same electronic health record. The communication is sometimes a little more efficient. Notes go back and forth easily. There's secure, system email. The staff sort of all knows, who they're working for. They know the rules. So there are a lot of advantages. But what happened was over the years, I lost touch with all the other specialists, the independents, and the specialists employed by other competing hospital systems. I came to a point where I didn't know who the new, young, incredibly well-trained, talented specialists were who were working for somebody else. So when I went independent again, you know, gosh, almost 10 years ago, all of a sudden, two things happened. One, I had to get to know all those other hospital system employed specialists that I didn't know. I found out there were some incredible talents out there that I wish I'd known, although I was certainly would have been discouraged from referring to them. But it was exciting to meet all these new doctors that I had not known or had much contact with. You mentioned physician liaison persons earlier. That's one person who really opened some doors for me. So I began to expand my go-to panel, as you mentioned earlier. I had to create a whole new, but it was a much broader panel. And the physician liaisons were one of the ways I did that. And I went and visited these physicians that I did not know and had not had relationship with. They opened those doors for me. But the other thing that was interesting was all of a sudden those other system employed specialists, they were so excited to meet me. Like, oh, you know, Dr. White, I've seen a few of your patients over the years and we know who you are, but wow, we're so glad you're independent now. And we really look forward to working with you. I mean, it was a really good feeling to hear that and to feel that your referrals were really valued. Just very sincerely valued. So, a lot of virtues to being system employed, a lot of advantages being independent in that you have the flexibility and the ability to make the referral that you want to make. And it sometimes simply comes down to the patient's insurance. It doesn't come down to who writes your paycheck.
Right, right. I think that, it's been wonderful to see how you've thrived in the system that your own personal system that you've created. What you've done as far as meeting people, it's a shame, really, that it has to be like that. Mm-hmm. The one thing that I think about, and I just came up with the 45th anniversary of my medical school class was this year. I wasn't able to attend, but we did have some great Zoom sessions over the last couple of years. And, you know, you think about how close you were with the people in your medical school class and how everybody basically was on the same page. There was no real tribalism. We're all medical students. We're all in it together. Mm-hmm. And the one thing, particularly with physician-physician relationships that I grieve about is that camaraderie and that collegiality that you had in medical school, all of a sudden you're sort of thrust into silos, into a tribalism of various specialties and things where the people that you can really relate to as a physician because of the stresses that we have, of the anxieties and anguish that we sometimes have, sometimes really the only people that can understand that are fellow physicians who have been in that same boat. And I think any opportunity that we have to join with people is so important. And I think that's particularly true for family physicians because we don't have the hospital system for most of us anymore. We begin to feel isolated. That's the worst thing that can happen to a family physician professional is to start feeling isolated. So the things that you have talked about, the things that both of us have talked about today, I think that's the most critical thing to me is being able to maintain and establish new and stronger relationships with other physicians. I encourage again, like we've done many times on this podcast, for the family physicians out there who are maybe feeling a little isolated to get into the North Carolina Academy, meet your fellow physicians, and just meet your physicians in general. It pays such incredible dividends for not only for our patients, but for our own mental health.
Right. No, that's so well said, Lee. And I just want to stress one other thing. I think morale among all physicians, but morale is pretty low. And it's particularly low in primary care and in family medicine. Folks are overworked. They feel underappreciated. They feel isolated, as you said. And it's real important for family physicians to remind themselves that, and they just need to think back on their med school days, that, you know, when they were in the classroom with those subspecialists, they were performing just as well as them. They need to remind themselves that they need to keep their morale and their self-esteem up. And one of the ways to do it is to create and maintain those close relationships with their colleagues so they can share cases and vent. Very important to maintain our morale and the morale of our colleagues.
Yes, absolutely.
So, Lee, we've talked extensively about this subject. There's so much to it. There are many angles to it. Any closing thoughts you have that you want to share as we kind of wrap this up?
Yeah, training your staff to help you with referrals. I just had a few things I'd like to point out to them about that. Many times we've talked about this, that the staff feels an ownership with the patients that you see. When the consultants came to visit the practice for when the physician liaison brought them around to say hello, I would introduce staff to them. And I tried to praise them in front of the consultants. And as you know, that goes a long way.
What a great idea.
You want to empower your staff to take ownership in the task, to make them, you know, feel integral, an integral part of the whole process. And take every opportunity to, you know, respectfully convey your satisfaction if the referral system is not working. Give them specific examples. It's that important. So I guess those are some of my closing thoughts of things that I think will be helpful in today's referral process.
Yeah, Lee, I really like how you have focused on this referral process being a team effort.
Yes.
I mean, it's not just you, the physician, finally getting on your laptop at 11 o'clock at night and, you know, sort of cranking out a form letter. It's getting your team, your staff all involved in the process, so everyone is sort of pulling in the same direction.
Mm-hmm.
Getting the letter off, looking for the return, making sure the patient is informed of their appointment, how to get there. It's a team effort, and you've done a great job explaining how to get your team involved in that.
Right.
That's so important. And it's not something you read anywhere.
Yeah. And it's something that you learn. And unfortunately, you oftentimes learn it after mistakes are made. So, go ahead and do these things.
Well, Lee, that's why we're doing this podcast is it's all about lessons learned. That implies that we made mistakes. We maybe didn't do things always as well as we had wanted to. We improved our processes. Gosh, I'm still practicing and I'm improving or trying to improve things all the time.
Right.
This wisdom that we, you know, supposedly have now, we use that word with a great deal of humility.
Very much so.
Lee, I'm going to I'm going to wrap this up with a couple of quotes. The first one, I don't know what speech it came from, but I can almost hear him say this. I can almost see him say it. And it was former President Barack Obama. And President Obama said, "Don't be afraid to ask questions. Don't be afraid to ask for help when you need it. I do that every day. Asking for help isn't a sign of weakness. It's a sign of strength. It shows you have the courage to admit when you don't know something and to learn something new."
Yeah. Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, what a humble, self-aware, honest quote that is.
Yes.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. And then the other, I'm not sure that I have the author's name, so I apologize if one of our listeners actually was the author of this, but I read along these lines, we should always be strong enough to stand alone, smart enough to know when you need help, and brave enough to ask for it. That's almost a paraphrase of President Obama, but it has much to do with this whole referral process, doing what's right, knowing your limitations, learning from it, and just managing it the best way you possibly can.
Right.
And adapting to, you know, the current world, adapting to the technology, the communication, all the impediments that get thrown in our way.
Right. And the momentum, the driver for all this is to do the right thing and the best thing for our patients.
Right. No, I couldn't agree more. Lee, thank you for joining me. And this has been a lot of fun.
It has been a lot of fun. Again, I hope that encourage people to, if they have some more tips that they've used in their practice about this, we'd love to hear from you.
Right. Send those to us at thefamilydoctorpodcast@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back next month with another amazing family physician. Until then, take good care of yourself and take good care of those you love.